Thank you for being in our assembly. I'd like to have a thought of a lesson tonight from the Old Testament in our using our Sunday evenings to examine some lessons that are valuable for us as New Testament Christians that we can learn from the pages of sacred history in the Old Testament. Tonight, a few of the many lessons from the book of Esther that we could look at. There are many in our attendance this evening that were not here last Sunday evening when we gave an overview of the book of Esther. So we will give you a brief overview of the book before we make some practical applications in the lesson that you might be in your thinking at the point that we are about some of these matters from the book. The book of Esther is set in the Persian Empire. The story properly fits in between probably chapter 6 and 7 of the book of Nehemiah, after Nehemiah's return to Israel and before Ezra's return to Israel with his group of what you and I would probably call refugees. The Jewish people in the book of Esther are those who remained behind in the Persian Empire when Nehemiah took a group of people to return to Judah. The main characters in the book are Esther and her cousin Esther, and the person who took over the responsibility of raising her, Mordecai, the king of Persia, Xerxes or Ahasuerus, and Haman. This story was rising from the what rises from this story at the end of the book is a feast that is known as the Feast of Purim that continues even among Jewish people today. And we talked about the fact and tried to emphasize the fact that even though God's name is not mentioned anywhere in the book, we do see His hand of providential care in caring for God's people, sustaining them and preventing them from being annihilated in a foreign land. And maybe the aim tonight is to help people to understand more completely how that God cares for His people and He provides for His people in His own way, not the way that we think that God should provide for His people or what would be most opportune for God to provide for His people, or the way that we think it would be wise for God to provide for His people. God provides for His people in His way. His way is always the best. Just thinking about the story in the book, chapter 1 deals with Vashti's downfall, who was the queen of Persia at the beginning of the story. The king's feast is noted by a historian whose writings survive even to this day. King commanded Vashti to come wearing a royal crown to show off her beauty, and Vashti refused that invitation from the king, something you did not do unless you wanted to be in trouble, refuse an order of the king. So the king made a proclamation, and Vashti would no longer have a royal position. And wives should honor their husbands. So the second major thing that takes place is Esther is selected by him and rises to be queen in Vashti's place. The king sent out officers to find women to replace the deposed queen. Esther was among the women selected. Mordecai sought each day to know of Esther's welfare, as he was naturally accustomed to doing as the person who cared for her since her parents had passed away. She prepared herself for a period of 12 months before being given an audience by the Persian king. And the Persian king ended up loving her more than all other women. She kept her nationality a secret. She did not reveal to the king that she was a Jew. Mordecai's service to the king is spoken of in chapter 2, verses 21 through 23. Mordecai overheard two of the king's servants plotting his assassination. He reported it to the king, and the two guilty men were hanged. Mordecai's name was recorded in the chronicles of history that belonged to the king as documenting the history of the country. That was a significant factor in the story. Haman is promoted in chapter 3, and all people were to bow down to him in his promotion, but Mordecai did not bow to him. So Haman plotted to destroy not only Mordecai, but also the Jews as a result of his failure to bow down. Haman convinced the king to kill all the Jews because they did not observe all the king's laws, which he charged when he had an audience with the king. And this was to be done on the 13th day of the 12th month. There was a proclamation issued in chapter 4, a proclamation of destruction for these people. Mordecai learned of the proclamation that was given by the king and adorned himself in sackcloth and ashes to demonstrate his sadness and sorrow over that condition. Esther heard about that. Mordecai warned Esther that she would not escape unless she does something. In chapter 4, verse 13 and 14 say this, "Then Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, 'Do not imagine that you in the king's palace can escape any more than all the Jews. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, and you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this?'" A very key expression in revealing the providence of God that is at work in the book. Esther's plan is begun in chapter 4 and verse 15. She goes into the king and is received favorably. And Esther invites the king and Haman to a feast. Haman's plot against Mordecai is spoken of in chapter 5. In his pride, he boasts to his family about the wealth as he enjoys as a result of serving the king. He boasts about the king's recognition of him and promoting him to a position of honor. He boasts about his invitation along with the king to the queen's feast. And the family of Haman plots Mordecai's death by hanging on a 50-cubit high gallows, which will be prepared for him. In chapter 6, we read some information about honoring Mordecai. The king has a sleepless night, and he's reading the historical records, and he came across the account of Mordecai's service to him in saving his life. And since no honor was given to him when it happened, the king decided that he was very much deserving of honor and should be honored. So the king asked Haman what should be done in a situation where someone served the king and it needed to be recognized, without mentioning his name, of course. And Haman, thinking that the king was referring to him as the one who should receive the honor, that he was being honored and recognized, devised an elaborate plan to honor himself, he thought, to use a royal robe and let that person wear a royal robe and ride on a royal horse and carry the royal crest and be led by noble princes. "Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor." Haman is then humiliated and having to carry out his plan of honor, not for himself, but for Mordecai. Esther's plan is completed in chapter 7. Esther reveals to the king what her heritage is. She tells what has been devised against her people, and Esther brings the charge in the front of the king against Haman at this second feast. The king is very angry, and Haman is taken out and hanged on his own gallows. The salvation of Mordecai and the Jewish people is spoken of in chapter 8. Esther speaks to the king about this law of destruction that's been declared on her people. The king proclaims that the Jewish people, not being allowed to change the law that he's already made, but he proclaims then that the Jewish people will be allowed to defend themselves and to fight their enemies on the day that a destruction attempt would be made on these people. Chapter 9 tells us about the victory of the Jewish people over their enemies. The Jewish people fight, and many of the Persian people take the side of the Jews in that fight. Many are converted to Judaism. The enemies are killed. Haman's 10 sons are killed and hanged also on the gallows. A second day of fighting is proclaimed and approved. And then in chapter 9, we have the celebrations of their victories. On the 14th day of the month Adar, there was a rest in the villages, but in Shushan, the rest was not until the 15th day. Both days are honored as a result in this Feast of Purim that still survives today. The book ends talking about some of Mordecai's notoriety. A strange story, but a very intriguing story to read about, especially when you view it from the standpoint of God's hand is at work in this story. We talked about some lessons that we could learn, but a few just to emphasize of the ones that we didn't talk about necessarily. God can use evil men to accomplish good things for His people. How many times in reading through Bible history have we seen that very thing? That evil men rise to a position of power or a position of influence over someone else, and they suppress the people of God, or they fight against God's instructions, or they rebel against God's will, only to end up destroying themselves. And the rise of God's people is seen. The king of Persia was an evil man. In chapter 1, we are told, Haman was an evil man. The king of Persia, the evil of that man ended up working for Esther's salvation. And Haman's evil purposes ended up working for the salvation of the Jewish people, to keep them from being destroyed. It's a strange turn of events. It's not a natural turn of events when history of men are being recorded. And I think we can see God's hand, providential hand in that, if we look closely enough. In the New Testament, what does that mean for us, that God can use some evil men to accomplish good things for His people? It means that God is still alive today, that God has people today, that God cares for His people today, and He works behind the scenes in favor of His people today to accomplish good for them. Paul, when he wrote to New Testament Christians in Romans chapter 8 and verse 28, said, "And we know that God causes all things to work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to His purpose." That's New Testament information. That's information that's good for us today to realize that and to understand that. God works for good for His people. We may not always be able to define exactly what that is, because God's ways are so much higher than man's ways, aren't they? We can't know in every specific situation and put our finger on something and say, "Well, I know that God is behind this specific thing." We can't know that. The Scriptures don't reveal that to us. God chose not to reveal that to us. But we do know and take great confidence as God's people that God works behind the scenes, not to destroy us, not to hurt us, but for our good. Paul tells us that in Romans 8 and verse 28. God can even use evil people for the benefit of good people. We may not always see it, but God does that very thing. Secondly, courage is certainly a virtue worth rewarding. Don't you, whenever you hear a story of courage of someone in everyday life or some strange situation, where you read about what happens in their lives and you think, that person had a great amount of courage, don't you appreciate that attribute of someone's life? And don't you kind of exalt that person because of what they endured and what they went through and what strength of character they demonstrated when they were shown to be courageous? We take note of those things and appreciate those things in people. Eddie Rickenbacker said, courage is doing what you're afraid to do. There can be no courage unless you're scared. And I think that's probably true. Do you think Esther had any fear whatsoever to go before the king, uninvited, to make a request, and then to reveal her heritage, and then to advise him to do something that ran contrary to a previous proclamation of his? She took her life in her own hands. She could have died on the spot. If the king became angry at her, if the king had decided no one comes before me uninvited, take her out and cut her head off. She had to be a courageous person and a much to be appreciated person. The courage of Mordecai in refusing to bow down before Haman and give him honor. W.T. Sherman said, I would define true courage to be a perfect sensibility of the measure of danger and a mental willingness to endure it. You understand full well what the danger is, and you're afraid, but you rise to meet the challenge anyway. That's what courage is. The courage of Esther in entering the king's presence. Well, what does that have to do with us today? One passage will tell us. 2 Timothy 1, verses 7 and 8. For God has not given us a spirit of timidity. He has not given us a spirit of cowering down and hiding in front of obstacles, but of power and love and discipline. Therefore, do not be ashamed of the testimony of our Lord or of me, his prisoner, Paul said, but join with me in suffering for the gospel according to the power of God. Paul was a courageous man. It takes a courageous person or a person determined to be courageous to be a Christian in today's world. Because of the obstacles that are there, because of the people that oppose us, because we stand for the truth. We live a different lifestyle, and that condemns the wicked. And people become angry, and they want to take it out on us. It takes a courageous person to be a Christian, even today. A third lesson we can think about is the fact that pride goes before destruction. Benjamin Franklin, in his autobiography, wrote this, there is perhaps no one of our natural passions so hard to subdue as pride. Beat it down, stifle it, mortify it as much as one pleases. It is still alive. Even if I could conceive that I had completely overcome it, I should probably be proud of my humility. Pride is a difficult thing to beat down in our lives. Haman's pride is what ended up promoting Mordecai. Pride is a powerful motivator in people to do things, and most oftentimes, things that are unrighteous or things that are wicked. Did you hear about the clever salesman who closed hundreds of sales with this line? Let me show you something several of your neighbors said that you couldn't afford. Pride would motivate that person, if they couldn't afford it, to show their neighbors, oh yes, I can afford it. The salesman is very successful with that line. Haman's pride then ended up destroying himself and destroying his descendants. Pride kills. During the Battle of the Wilderness in the Civil War, Union General John Sedgwick was inspecting his troops, and at one point he came to a parapet over which he gazed out in the direction of the enemy. His officers suggested that that was very unwise and he ought to duck down while passing the parapet. Nonsense, snapped the general. They couldn't hit an elephant at this distance. And those were the last words that he spoke. A moment later, he fell to the ground, fatally wounded. Pride. Pride goes before destruction, the wisest man said in Proverbs 16 and verse 18. Pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before stumbling. There's trouble in pride. There's trouble in a haughty spirit. Nothing good ever comes out of it. Another lesson we can learn in the book. Anger does nothing really. If we don't get it under control and we don't cool it down, anger does nothing but build our own gallows for us. Frederick Buchner said this, of the seven deadly sins, anger is possibly the most fun. To lick your wounds, to smack your lips over grievances long past, to roll over your tongue to the prospect of bitter confrontation still to come, to savor the last toothsome morsel, both the pain you are given and the pain you are giving back. In many ways, it's a feast fit for a king. The chief drawback is that what you are wolfing down is yourself. The skeleton at the feast is you. Anger can destroy ourselves. Haman's anger drove his hatred for Mordecai. It drove him to build the gallows prior to the king making a judgment. Then the king learned of Haman's efforts and he was hanged on his own gallows. A lady once came to Billy Sunday and tried to rationalize her angry outbursts. She said, "There's nothing wrong with losing my temper. I blow up and then it's all over." And Sunday replied, "So does a shotgun. And it took the damage, and look at the damage that a shotgun leaves behind." And that's the way anger is. In the New Testament, we have this instruction in Ephesians 4, beginning in verse 31. Let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and slander, the clamor and the slander go along with the anger and the wrath. Let these be put away from you along with all malice. Malice attends anger and wrath as well. Paul said, let these be put away from you. The man who saw Jesus Christ and received revelation from him to pass on to other people told us, don't behave this way. This is not the way of Christ. And then certainly, a last lesson that we'll think about tonight from the book, and one that's very important, and we want to emphasize once again, God takes care of His people. God elevated Esther to be queen. Who would have ever imagined such a thing? A Jewish girl becoming queen of Persia. Who would have thought that that would ever be possible? God ensured that Mordecai's loyalty to the king was recorded in the historical record so that the king would see it at a later time. God worked in the timing of the feasts that we were told about in the book. God was involved in the king of Persia's insomnia and the fact that he read from these books in order that he might be able to sleep that night. God uses Haman's gallows for his own purpose, and God uses the circumstances of the whole story to end up finally bringing great blessings to his people. God takes care of his people. Did it end in Old Testament days? No, it didn't, did it? A passage of Scripture from the New Testament, Hebrews 13, beginning in verse 5. Make sure that your character is free from the love of money, being content with what you have. For he himself said, I will never desert you, nor will I ever forsake you. That's God speaking to humankind. I'm on your side. I'll never leave you. You may leave me, but I will never leave you. He goes on to say, so that we may confidently say, the Lord is my helper. I will not be afraid. What will man do to me? Who helps me? The Lord does. Is it an occasion for fear? No, it's not. God cares for his people, and he cares for me. What great and powerful lessons from the book of Esther that we can learn and appreciate and cultivate and practice in our own lives. We've reviewed the book of Esther and noticed some very practical lessons that come to us from that. Let's realize that God takes care of his people, and we are God's people today if we do his will today. Have you been doing God's will? Can we help you to do God's will if you haven't? We stand ready to encourage you, to help you, to pray with you, to pray for you, to hear your confession tonight if you need to become a Christian by confessing that you believe with all of your heart that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, just like the cases of conversion that are recorded for us in the pages of the New Testament. And upon that confession, you're willing to repent of sins, to turn from them, to change your lifestyle, and to be immersed, baptized in water for the forgiveness of sins, as the Bible teaches, raised up out of that water to walk a new life, as Paul wrote to the Romans about in Romans chapter 6. Can we help you with that tonight? We'd be delighted to do that. If we can, please come to the front and let us know while we stand together and encourage you by singing this song.